Have you ever wondered why it is that we do what we do and who we do it with? Then this is a podcast for you. An exploration of human beings through systemic psychology and Unani biotypes. With Rodrigo Garcia Plates, Ross Everett, and Brian McElhaney. This is Biotypical. So last week on the podcast, I was in the devastated space because of all the obvious things that are going on, the shootings and whatnot. And I said, we just need to talk to somebody who's worked in government, has some sort of an understanding of government. And I said, who better than my friend Jake Maccabee, who is so professional. Look at the Zoom photo he has. He's in a suit and tie. It's fantastic. Jake and I met when we interned on the Colbert Report back in 2008.
Wow.
Yeah. I may be still to this day the best summer of my life. Really fun. Jake came from a background more interested in politics. I came from a background more interested in comedy. And then I think we, you know, rubbed off on each other a little bit because Jake is also incredibly funny. And I am also incredibly angry at politics. So, you know, we kind of, you know, metamorphosed in that way. But Jake has gone on to be a speechwriter for the Attorney General of the United States.
That's right. That's right. That's what you did.
Now you remember.
Yes. Yeah.
He's also written, or he worked with Obama during the 2000.
Yes.
12.
What was your Obama speech you worked on? Like, there was like a pretty big one.
It was during
the
debate.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. It was the debate line. Mm-hmm. What was it?
It was the horses and bayonets line is the one that Ross is really excited about.
That was so good.
And that I was a part of.
Well, for the listening audience, I think we should absolutely recap what that horses and bayonets line
is. Oh, gosh. So Mitt Romney was a big fan. So hi, everyone, first of all. second of all, Mitt Romney was really fond of saying during the 2012 campaign that America had fewer ships than it had in the Navy than it had in something like 1918, which is, I guess, was true at the time, but also kind of a ridiculous comparison. And so we were sort of waiting for him to say it in a debate. And he said, America has fewer ships now than we did in 1918. And President Obama said, we also have fewer horses and bayonets than we had in 1918, because now we have submarines and we have tanks and we have, you know.
That's such a good angle.
Weapons that have been around for the last, you know, century.
It's a sick burn.
It was a sick burn. It was a sick burn. Most of 2012 was just about laying on sick burns, which is really you know, politics in general is just sick burn.
I was about to say, like, this was the beginning of the sick burn era, and now it's become a lot more like childish insults.
Oh my God, did you begin the sick burn era? Is it?
It's me. It's my fault.
You're the reason why. It's just like a bunch of like childhood school bullies now, like just yelling at each other on Twitter.
Yeah, that's all we do. I started it.
Was that your line? Like, did you sort of pitch like, hey, if he says this, say this horse is a bayonet thing.
It's a team. The way the debate.
It's a writer's room.
Yeah, exactly. It's a writer's room. It comes from the principal. It sort of ascends from the principal and just sort of like finds its way into the ether. That's how all of this works.
Yeah, yeah. That makes sense.
We're not recording anymore. So cool. That was your line though, right?
it's a team effort.
Yeah, okay.
President writes his own stuff.
I wanted Jake to come on because I feel like we could really pick his brain about what's going on, what his angle is. I mean, Jake, you've also been on, I don't want to say the big channel that you've been on because of what it really associates with, but you've been on television as a talking head to talk about what's going on in American politics, correct?
Yes, I have been on television to talk about what's going on in American politics. In some instances, that has just involved me sitting amidst, you know, four or five other yelling people. And then I'm just the person they're yelling at. So, I feel like I have a good sense of politics.
Are you talking about like one of those sort of like, I feel like they were doing Zoom before Zoom, where it's like a bunch of like little boxes.
Yeah, where you're a square. So I had actually been there in person. I've been on a couch with two people on each side turned towards me screaming.
Wow.
And if you haven't done political commentary that way, then you are missing nothing. So yes, I have been a part of these conversations to an extent that is sometimes more constructive and sometimes less constructive. So happy to be here, happy to give whatever insight I can, or just to, you know, commiserate for a while and then, you know, weep quietly until you're all tired of watching me cry.
So, okay, I'll start you off with a softball question. A lot of people say that we have a gun problem in this country, and other people say that we have a mental health problem disguised as a gun problem. Thoughts?
We have a gun problem.
What an easy question.
Yeah, just lob it right over the plate.
Yes so, or no, move on.
Yeah, we very clearly have a gun problem, and the reason, that's not to say that that mental health isn't an issue and that we need to be focused on making sure that people have the resources that they need and the support that they need to be healthy and happy and productive and to be able to do the things they need to do. However, the idea that America has a mental health problem that is orders of magnitude higher or greater than any other country in the world is bananas. What America does have is a gun problem that is orders of magnitude higher than any other country in the world. We have more gun deaths, more gun violence, more gun ownership than any other country. And all of that cannot be attributed to mental health challenges. And honestly, the idea that this is all somehow, when I say this is all, I mean like the needless slaughter of, you know, hundreds, thousands of people across the United States, that this is all the result of, you know, poor mental health or a few people with mental health or issues or video games or rap music or whatever other boogeyman, you know, people in a particular side of the political debate want to call out. It's not only like silly, it's also insulting, because when we talk about these issues, there's a way to talk about this where we're actually dealing in reality and trying to come up with useful solutions. And then there's just noise. And this is just noise when people start to find other ways to talk to other reasons to blame or other problems that might be an issue. The issue is we have way too many guns, way too many people have them, and they're way too easy to get.
I feel like Rodrigo's Googling something that he can bring up right now. Yeah.
Yes, he is, but he's not ready.
Okay.
I mean, it's such a good point. It's just so, I was listening to a bunch of like Republican pundits talk. And as you know, it's like, you know, there's Ted Cruz's thing about like, it was the doors. There's too many doors open in the school or whatever. Or like all the other ways where it's like, we have to like find these people. This kid had like, was carrying around like a bag of dead cats or something. And people were like, see, there are warning signs. We have to figure out how to like catch the red flagged people before like we just take away everyone's guns. And it's like, yeah, those things are part of it. There are, I mean, the doors aren't, but like, you know, mental health and stuff is part of, you know, it's an issue that leads to violence. But guns are clear. The fact that we just have so many is clearly the overriding thing. And it's just so funny that people can compartmentalize and be like, it's not guns at all. It's only this. It's like, it's probably a mix of a lot of things. And guns are a huge portion of the pie. But it's just very weird when you watch a gun advocate. And I say gun advocate, I'm talking about people who are like super into the idea that like guns have nothing to do with it at all, and it's only this other thing, not being able to distinguish between that there's a multifaceted thing that's leading to this, and guns are clearly a big part of it. When you see them try to work around it and like try to, I don't know, do some like twisty logic to make it seem not true, they sound so idiotic. It's just so interesting how people like can define it as one thing, and then just like, you know, their logic can stick to that when it's obviously not the case.
Yeah, it's really frustrating. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to have you heard someone of the Swiss cheese problem? I heard this is a response to what we've got going on in this country with mass shootings, where it's like, it's a Swiss cheese problem, meaning like if you put a piece of Swiss cheese on top of it, there are still so many holes to go through. But if you stack multiple slices of Swiss cheese on top of it, the holes, it gets harder and harder to get through. Like we need multiple solutions to this problem.
I wish you had just talked about how you were out of Swiss cheese. I wish you'd been like, yeah, this is problem. Actually really
this,
important.
This could have taken a really fun turn.
Yeah. Come on, Ross. Lighten this up a bit. All That's right. Interesting. I'm trying to understand that metaphor a little bit. So the Swiss cheese problem is...
Well, it's like, so if you put like let's say like, you know...
A slice of Swiss cheese is a solution is what you're saying.
Well, think of it as a block of Swiss cheese. Yeah. So okay. Like you put a block of Swiss cheese and it's like, everyone's like, no, there are holes in this argument. There are holes here and holes here and holes here. So there are a lot of ways, like one piece of Swiss cheese won't solve the problem. But if you keep stacking Swiss cheese blocks on top of itself, like the holes will eventually, like, you know, even if you can get through one block, you'll be blocked by another. So it's like eventually this becomes a really solid way to block the problem. I'm not doing a great job of explaining this.
Yeah,
or
I'm just so
like,
confused.
Yeah, I'm really hungry now.
Yeah. So. I was gonna say, I'm not doing a great job of explaining this or a good job. So I'm going to.
So what you're saying is like even Swiss cheese, like that's full of holes. If you cover all the holes little by little, it still works. Like,
yeah,
you can still fix it.
It's not like you need one solution. It's not like, hey, here's our block, right? Here's our thing. It's a guns problem. Oh no, it's a mental health problem. It's like you need to address.
I see what
both,
you're saying. Everyone's looking at everyone else's piece of Swiss cheese and going, there's holes in your Swiss
exactly,
cheese. And it's like, yeah,
you.
There's holes in mine too, but let's put them together and see what happens. And
exactly.
Then our sandwich will be way too fucking big at the end, but at least, you know.
Jake's Twitter is one of my favorite places to go for, like, kind of comedic reflections on what's going on in our government, where it's like we've tried nothing and we're all out of ideas. You know, like every single time the like this whole thing happens. But like he always has like really good, almost like screenplays. Like he writes like dialogues between like Democrats and Republicans in the House. And I always just find them to be spot on. So that's we'll leave that in the show notes below. It's at JD Maccabee on Twitter if you guys are into some political humor. But
I just found an alarming
piece
of information.
Okay, let's hear it.
According to an Army survey did in 2017, which is the like most up-to-date information that I could find right now, there is more guns than people in the States.
Yes,
like,
that is
according
true.
According to that survey, there is 326 million people and 393 million firearms.
Wow.
And this is Army information.
Yeah.
That is...
I think the one thing that I read recently said... It said 3% of Americans own half of America's gun stock, which amounts to something like 133 million guns. It's, I mean,
what?
It's a tiny amount of people. Yeah, it's a very, it's an enormous amount of weaponry owned by a small segment of the population. So yeah, it's pretty wild.
What's your insight into lobbying, and specifically, because in my mind, when I think of gun violence, I think of the NRA. Right? Like that's the thing, the National Rifle Association. I've heard a lot of hoopla about who funds them, who they fund, the agenda behind it. Before I go into my wild speculations, I'd like to hear kind of, Jake, from your perspective, like, did you, while you were there, you know, in DC, did you feel the presence of lobbyists? And specifically, what's your take on the NRA?
So I didn't feel the presence of lobbyists from my perch. You know, I was pretty insulated from that kind of stuff. And especially I think at the Department of Justice, in the place that I was, that's not something that I came into contact with. I mean, the NRA is like is a gun sales organization. That's what they're about. It's not about gun ownership. It's about gun sales. And so everything that happens is going to be a reason to buy more guns. If there aren't a lot of shootings right now, now is a great time to buy guns. If there are shootings, it's you should get armed in case there's a shooting. And then after a shooting, it's you should get armed in case people try to take guns away. You should be armed. It's always you should be armed.
With guns, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Right. The policy solution is always, what if we just sold more guns? and that's not, obviously that's not a good solution. It's not a helpful solution. We've seen even in, I was going to say the most recent, but it's not the most recent because today there was another shooting in, was it Tulsa in a
that
medical center?
That was yesterday. Yeah,
sorry,
yeah.
Yesterday.
Oklahoma, right?
Yeah. Yes. And so.
There was even one in Van Nuys in Southern California.
Yeah. I mean. Yeah.
It was outside of the school when people were leaving. So they're like, good luck arming your teachers and having less doors there.
Are
we arming doctors too because of the hospital?
Exactly. We have, it's just. At the end of the day, that argument just ladders up to we should give everybody multiple guns in case someone around them tries to shoot them. And it's it's a wild way. It is a Wild West way to think about public safety, and it doesn't make any sense. It's a terrible idea. And in fact, even we saw in Texas, we saw police waiting outside for an hour and not going into this active shooter situation. Now, think about for a moment the idea that we have allowed people to easily access weapons that are so scary and so deadly that armed police officers will not go in after a shooter. That's where we're at.
Yeah.
Well, what can you do with your little handgun with like 8 bullets against someone with an assault rifle?
Which is why the obvious solution is, well, let's prevent people from having assault rifles. That seems way easier.
Give everybody an assault rifle.
Give everybody an assault rifle and just everybody spray in all directions.
It is an insane thing to be like, well, the answer is just everyone gets a gun. And it's like, can you imagine like everyone walking around with a gun being like, see, look how happy and safe we all are. Look at us with our guns at this barbecue.
That's a war zone. That's a war zone. If everybody needs to be armed with a deadly weapon, that's a war zone.
Yeah, I mean, that's literally, I'll just put people, if everyone just has a gun, everyone's going to be so on edge all the time. Like the idea of that fixing things and calming things down is insane.
Yeah. You know how this sounds from the outside, and this is very crazy? Think of it this way. Why is it that men fist fight way more than women?
Bigger fists.
Bigger fists.
Wait, is that really the reason?
Testosterone? Oh, it's bigger fists.
It has to do with strength. Okay. Like the reason men tend to fight more is because men have the strength to end the fight. In other words, it's easy for a man to knock out another man. They're like, they have enough strength, and then the problem is over. Like the fight is done. If you're not that strong, then going into a fight without having the strength to actually stop someone and stop the fighting altogether, then you're just exposing yourself to more damage if you don't have the strength to do it. That's why it's not a possibility if you're a weak man or if you're a weak human being in general. Now, having said that, the whole argument about guns and arming more people sounds like someone biologically explaining why strong people are more prone to fist fighting and going like, okay, so the solution is make everybody strong and get everybody on steroids so that they all have the ability to stop a fight by fighting better.
I can see
that's literally how ridiculous it sounds.
Yeah.
And it's always fascinating to listen to right-wing people, again, from outside the States, to watch them exploit a very funny linguistical problem. Because your word for arm is the same word for like weapon, and that's how you're interpreting the Constitution, which is mind blowing.
So wait, say more to that.
It's all about the amendment that says that you have the right to bear arms.
Right.
What that means is that you have the right to defend yourself, and it comes from arms, as in your physical like extremity called arm, not weapon. But because it's the exact same word, we can reinterpret it in a completely new way.
It can be anything. You have a right to own an Uzi.
Exactly.
Well, so it was regarding weapons. If my memory does serve me correctly, that the right to bear arms is the right to bear weapons and form an organized militia. And it was initially instated to prevent from government overreaching. Like, also keep in mind the context of where our country was at when it was writing the Constitution, which was it just freed itself from the oppressive arms of the British rule, where they felt like they were being unfairly governed because they had all these taxes that they needed to pay, but they weren't being represented at all in the British Parliament. So they come and they say, like, we won't let anyone overstep their boundaries again, therefore we are going to make it a right to have a militia to rise up against the government.
And that philosophically means that you have the right to defend yourself.
Yes.
Like, the literal translation into Spanish of bearing arms means levantarse en armas. And we even use the word weapon, arma. And that doesn't mean that you can own a gun. It's a concept that means that you can defend yourself, that you can stand your ground. That's it. It has nothing to do with gun ownership. It's actually a philosophical concept about being able to stand your own ground and like protect your traditions, your culture, like who you are. But that's it. It has nothing to do with gun ownership.
Well, you know what's interesting? Because it says a well-regulated militia. And none of this is well regulated.
Yep.
I think that's, I mean, I feel like we're also in an echo chamber, just we're going to sit around and agree with ourselves all day about this. But I want to know. Yeah.
Sorry for interrupting, but there's something very important to break down about this, which is, like, I don't know if you guys want to go down this philosophical rabbit hole, but this has a lot to do with how the U.S. was created and understood. Because what creates, what made the U.S. like the superpower of the universe has a lot to do with the freedom of how it was created. And the lack of like control and structure and how it was created. So who regulated the railroads, for example, when they were being built?
Corporations, maybe? I don't know.
Corporations.
Yeah.
It's one of the only places in the world where the railroad was going to be was a corporate decision, not a government decision. Like, there's even like an amazing show that the History Channel made at some point that gives like really good information when it comes to this. And I think it's called The Men Who Built America. And it's literally about the amazing corporations that started the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Harrigan brothers, like all of that created the whole industry that we now understand as the United States of America. And that created such freedom in what people can create, which is amazing. But at the same time, an understanding of personal liberties on top of the common, like the well-being of the population in general, which is a completely different standard from any other country in the world. This is also why you have so many archaeological sites that haven't been explored.
What do you mean?
Yeah. Do you have any idea the amount of like ruins, pyramids, and amazing things that are in the States that have never been explored?
No.
Because you guys are one of the few countries in the world where if you buy a piece of property, whatever's under the ground is yours.
Yeah.
And that's not true in most of the world. Therefore, if there is something underneath my house, it belongs to Mexico. Like, it belongs to the country, not to me. But if it belongs to me, hey, this archaeological site is mine.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's cool. There's a bunch of, like, hidden cool secrets in America. Ooh, this is exciting. This is, it makes
That's
for...
That's a Nicolas Cage movie.
The new Da Vinci Code or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's in our own backyard.
Do you know the Nazca Lines?
No.
In Peru, they have one of those like unsolved amazing mysteries. I believe it's Peru. And it was created by the Nazca cultures. And people had no idea that this is there because there are figures that you can see from a plane, but you cannot see them when you're standing on the ground.
Wait, what?
What?
What are you saying?
Have you heard of this, Jake? You're not.
Yeah, these
like...
are like it looks kind of like crop circles, right? But it's like.
But in the middle of the desert.
Yeah.
It's part of the same desert and stones. We can Google it. Just put Nazca Lines with a Z.
Yeah.
And literally, like, they put, like, some earth and stones together to create those shapes.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't see them from the ground. You need to fly, like, really high up. Those things are massive. Like, massive.
Whoa.
And it's, like, eagles and, like, aliens and different animals and, like, different structures.
That's and, weird. Well, you can't see them from the ground.
No way. It's waving at us?
Yes, it is.
I've drawn that before.
I love how that's the most alarming thing to Ross, is that it's waving.
Yeah, Ross is like, he's waving? He sees me?
But the thing is, guess what? You guys have things like this in the States, and you build roads on top of them.
I'm going to find them. Well, that guy's cool. Is that a barfing monkey?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
This is
like a
the most haunting
mountain
one.
In the States and things like that. That no one knows how it got there or what culture it came from.
I wonder how many times life in society has built up on this planet and then extincted itself.
There are theories about it.
I'm sure. Jake, back to our extinction.
Let's get back to the
perfect segue.
Yeah.
Into the worst possible topic.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to Brian, did you have a question?
I was just thinking about a few things, like our Constitution, and just we're talking about just like when everything was written and everything. It's funny because, you know, people, you look back on like 2015, you watch movies from it, you think about politics, and people go like, ugh, what a different time. Like, we say that about things 6 years ago. So clearly something that was that many hundreds of years ago needs a full update. And I was going to say there was a show off Broadway, and then it moved to Broadway, called What the Constitution Means to Me. It was a one-woman show. I think you can watch it. I think they filmed it. This woman named Heidi Schreck did it. I saw it twice. I thought it had the most boring title I ever heard, so I didn't want to see it. And then I saw it, She's this woman who was a professional debater. When she was a kid, she loved debate. And she really talks about how the Constitution was her favorite thing. She knows it inside and out. And the whole show is like, do we need it anymore? Should we get rid of it? And I had never even thought about the concept of that happening. Anyway, at the very end, she has an actual like 15-year-old debater come on stage and they have a live debate on whether or not they should abolish the Constitution or keep it. And they do a coin flip to see like which side they should take. But it's like it's a live debate every night at the end of the show.
No wonder you love that.
It's awesome.
That is so cool. I want to see it.
But I think you can watch it on Amazon or something. But it was just one of those things where I was like, abolish the Constitution and rewrite it. I never even, in my head, I was like, no, it's set in stone. It's a thing that's always existed.
No.
And I was like, I know. I mean, I just grew up as a kid in America where that was just sort of, obviously it's not true, but like, I had never even thought of the concept of it until I saw the show. And now I'm like, yeah, maybe we need to do a full wipe clean, like wipe the slate clean and just kind of like start again and put rules down. It'll never happen. But
well, what's funny about that too is that I feel like every once in a while there's chatter about like we should have a constitutional convention and like everyone send delegates and have a conversation about what America should actually look like now based on what's going on now. What new rules, what new ideas do we need to set in stone? And everyone kind of goes into that idea thinking that the result is going to be something closer to where their head is at or what makes more sense to them. But then you look around at the people who are answering questions about the Constitution today, people who are legislators from states around the country and from communities around the country who show up and come up with, you know, insane ideas and wild theories and all that stuff. And you think those are the people who are actually going to end up writing a new constitution. And I want no part of that.
I know. It would be called the Nestle United States Constitution. And it would just be, it wouldn't be signed by forefathers. It would just be signed by different corporations. Like it'd be, it would look
sponsored
like a NASCAR.
Ford.
Exactly. Exactly.
There's a, I'm going to take a quick detour. I'll promise I'll land it back where we're talking about. But John Cleese, the comedian from Monty Python, was talking about one time he was writing a movie script and he lost the script. He fully just lost it. And he was furious. He'd been working for years on it and the script was done and he couldn't find it. So he's like, fuck it. Guess I have to rewrite it. So he rewrote it from scratch, finished the new draft, and then he found his old draft that he lost. And then he looked at him and his new draft, he was like, it was better line for line. Every single moment of it was better. And his whole thing was like, I was so scared that I lost this draft that I would lose everything. The truth is, all of the good stuff came back and all of the bad stuff just I didn't remember, and I replaced it, and it just got better. So I almost feel like that's we should lose the Constitution. You know what I'm saying? And then just rewrite it, and then I feel like the good stuff will come back. If this were to happen, I think we'd have to like burn it and start from like square one. But as Jacob was saying, who's going to do that? Like, which people are going to be the ones?
Maybe we need to start seeing the Constitution as the trauma that made sense for the country before.
That's exact. Well, okay, here we go. This is the biotypical, like. Yeah, we were in a traumatic relationship with the Constitution.
No, we're
we
in
have
a traumatic
grown
relationship with England.
Yes.
We left our ex.
And then we have grown, but we're keeping the same rules that we used to have in this traumatic relationship, and we need to now redefine how
so
we're
Constitution-
acting with.
Your constitution is basically your breakup manifesto.
Yes. It's our breakup.
Oh my gosh.
It's our breakup manifesto. The constitution was our breakup manifesto from
England.
Yeah. And now we're living,
you know,
by
what
that
it is?
Breakup
it's
manifesto.
Like when you're like, okay, well my parents won't let me have any junk food. So when I'm going off on my own, rule is junk food whenever I want it.
And then it's every day.
Taco Bell every day. And then people live by that. They go, no, we have to have Taco Bell today. And we're like, Taco Bell is killing us.
Or
it's literally
like,
putting us into the ground.
Now,
and they're like, no.
Who
that
is that
rule
directed
we set
at?
When we
Ross?
Were 18.
This comment is, is it me?
Yeah.
It's like when you break up with someone, you're like, fuck that. I'm going to live my life like this now. I'm going to date these people. This is who I am. I'm going to write it down every day. Like, these are my affirmations. That's what the Constitution was, our affirmations after a terrible breakup that, like, it makes no sense to hold on to right now. This is a great way of thinking about it.
It's absolutely true, because when you start traveling, you start realizing that most of the things that they told us are extremely dangerous within a country and are like absolute tyranny. When you actually experience them, you go like, people seem really happy here. Like, I'll give you an example. They constantly tell us that the worst thing that you can have is a king, right? like yeah. imperialism, like real imperialism, and a king that actually makes all the choices, et cetera, with no Congress, with no nothing. It must be the worst place in the world to live, right? Yeah, ask people from Dubai. Ask people from Oman.
That's going to be a whole other set of problems, though. I mean, I would say, the most pleasant way to live is with, like, a benevolent dictator, but a benevolent dictator becomes, like, a not-so-benevolent dictator pretty quickly. And you also have, like, less input into what goes on in your country, all that stuff.
Then why is Oman an amazing country and has been for a while now?
I suspect that there are a lot of reasons that I wouldn't want to live there. But I will say that, like, I think that, like, for all its flaws, and there are many, it is, and I am a person also who has said, like, the people who wrote the Constitution lived hundreds of years ago and didn't wash their hands. And so.
And had slaves.
Yeah, and, yeah, exactly. And owned people. So, like, maybe there's an opportunity to do better. However, given all of that, the result is pretty impressive, and has a lot of pieces to it that are still great ideas. Freedom of speech, awesome. Freedom of religion, cool. A little bit abused at times here in the United States and can get kind of twisted in weird ways. But, like, broadly, cool. There are lots of, you know, a jury of one's peers. I like that. There are lots of great provisions in there that are actually really impressive and well thought out, coming as they did hundreds of years ago, and that are still used pretty effectively today. Yes, there are a ton of problems that we're seeing both in original provisions of the Constitution and also in how those provisions are interpreted in this day and age or have been interpreted over time. We've made some adjustments to the Constitution over time, some good, getting rid of slavery, cool, some not so good, prohibition, and then we kind of like, we walked that back for a little while. But broadly, the sort of, the rubric that we've used, or the set of rules that we've used to govern us as a society since the United States was founded, has been pretty stable in some pretty positive ways. So yes, we are having enormous problems when it comes to particularly the Second Amendment, but also the interpretation of some other pieces of the Constitution. And that's part of the challenge of having a founding document that is written down, because rather than sort of everything being, there are pluses and minuses to things being written down versus being kind of a series of norms that build up over time. The downside of having everything written down is that you become this very litigious society where everything is kind of pushed and pulled and prodded by folks who want to interpret something in a slightly different way or find a new way to think about what's already written down, and you lose kind of the meaning behind it. Generally, we can say, like, well, obviously, you know, for example, in the Second Amendment, where we can say, look, this is really just all about making sure that there is an opportunity for defense against a tyrannical government. Fine. Or a well-regulated militia. We want to make sure that we are able to stand up and, you know, stand up an army if we need to. Fine. But then, of course, when you dig into specific words, you're able to make them say different things or say things they weren't intended to say, or move beyond the intention and say, you know, obviously people, you know, we spent a lot of time being like, look, obviously people back then, they just wanted to have a well-regulated militia. And now we look back, we have people who look back on the words that were written and say, well, this can be used to mean that every person in the United States needs to be able to own a tank. And if you try to take the tank away from me, then you are trampling all over the Constitution. And that's the challenge of having a written Constitution. It's also why some folks didn't want a Bill of Rights at all, because they thought that writing rights down meant that other rights were, you know, no longer going to be workable, or people would see them as lesser. This is the messy part of having not only a democracy, but sort of a written constitution where you say, let's all sit down and figure out what's important to us and then write those things down on a piece of paper that needs to be timeless and needs to last for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years well into the future. So, you know, pretty good job considering, but also we're a little bit held back by some of the complications and strictures of just the way that we've chosen to go about governing.
And I feel like you're opening up literally the core of the problem, which is there are so many things that work. And at the same time, if we're completely honest, the world is like at the best place it has ever been when it comes to humanity. Poverty, education, literacy, like whatever you look, healthcare, the possibility to get certain things, like so many things are working beautifully. And it's true. The world has never had the amount of abundance that we have today and like all of those indicators. The problem is every time we try to change something, it feels like any proposal sounds like throwing away the baby with the bathwater. And finding that common ground in which we still value certain things, we don't want to throw everything away, but there are others that need to be addressed. And the corporate values and the corporate interests become a massive problem. And to circle back to what we were talking about at the beginning, I don't think a gun problem and a mental health problem are mutually exclusive. And the thing is, you have a gun problem that mental issues will exacerbate, but it's still a gun problem.
Agreed.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, just thinking biotypically again, I feel like this is also like when you work on a person, if a person is incredibly resistant to change, like when they're first like maybe going through therapy or something, I know I kind of had little bits of this. I was so upset with the idea of needing to change anything because I was like, but I'm good. My core is great. I know it. Like even admitting small faults felt like it was like throwing out the baby with the bathwater, like you say, but with my whole being. And I had to learn that like, one, the two bounce off each other. And just because you're learning to kind of wipe yourself clean doesn't mean that the good stuff is not going to come back. It's going to come back better once you sort of like are able to. But like I viewed the whole thing holistically. And so I couldn't like take apart little bits of it, which I feel like often when Republicans, if you like insult the Constitution or something, they're like, love it or get the fuck out then. It's like, whoa, it's not like.
Did you see that reporter go up to Ted Cruz and he was like, what did he say? Like, this is
The British reporter?
Yeah, the way in which America is exceptional, like in terms of like, this is like essentially an outstanding way that like America, it has an exceptional gun problem. And Ted Cruz is like, well, I'm sorry that you find American exceptionalism to be a bad thing. Like it was. Here, Jake, here's the real question. How the fuck is Ted Cruz still in office?
That's the real question.
He's
one of the worst politicians.
But he keeps getting elected.
Yeah, it is fascinating. Like, what about him attracts anyone? In any capacity, from looks to rhetoric, what about him?
I think it's his beard.
Yeah, you do? Yeah. Did you ever see that shit that went around? I think it was him. It was them filming a commercial with their family, and it was like all the outtakes of them just like awkwardly. Like, it's so weird. Yeah. It's like you're watching a bunch of aliens hang out. I don't know what it is about him.
I don't know. I don't remember who. Well, I know that that Al Franken used to say that, you know, I like Ted Cruz better than anybody else. Like, I like Ted Cruz better than anybody else in the Senate, and I hate Ted Cruz. I mean, I don't think Ted Cruz is particularly beloved by any of his colleagues or indeed any of his fellow Texans or any of his
colleagues. Yeah, from, like, I mean, school. I've seen interviews.
If you can find someone who loves Ted or who will admit to being a friend of Ted Cruz, I will give you $10. But I don't know. I mean,
careful. Ted Cruz is on the line.
I know. Oh boy. You know, we took a swing in 2018 and came pretty close to beating Ted Cruz.
Was that Beto O'Rourke?
That was Beto O'Rourke in 2018, coming up a couple of points short on Ted Cruz for the U.S. Senate in Texas, which is not nothing. It has been a long time since a Democrat was serving as a Texan. It was Lloyd Benson, right? Who later became Michael Dukakis' running mate. But, you know, it's been a long time since we came anywhere close in Texas. So good on us, but obviously a lot more work to do. And part of that is just it's a big state with some very baked in political proclivities, and it's really, really hard to get people to change their political affiliation. Even if we're not asking them to change their political ideology, changing a political affiliation is really, really tough. So that's like a more serious answer to why do people keep voting for Ted Cruz than we probably needed. But it's real hard to knock off a sitting senator anyway, in an election. It's especially hard to do it if you're a Democrat in Texas. And we came close and would have been better if we had come closer. But unfortunately, this is sort of where we are, at least for now.
So you think Greg Abbott stays as the governor as well for that same reason?
I mean, Godspeed to Beto again. I appreciate his service on behalf of the country and his fellow Texans. I mean, we'll see. There are lots of reasons why people should not be fans of Greg Abbott, in addition to all the things that I'm not a fan of him for, which is everything from lousy and hate-mongering positions on LGBTQ folks to lousy and hate-mongering positions on abortion to everything else. And then in addition to that, of course, it's a guy who has run the power grid in Texas into the ground and also spent a ton of, you know, Texas's tax dollars causing problems at his own border in order to make some kind of a point about immigration. It's not, and then of course there's the shootings of it all. So lots of reasons not to like Greg Abbott. Statewide races in Texas are really tough. And so, you know, hats off to Beto for taking two swings at this, at a statewide race in Texas over the course of 4 years or 6 years, I guess, if you started in 2016. It's a tall order for sure, but, you know, never say never. And the only way that these state parties get better is with good people running and encouraging other people to turn out. The only way that we get a good message out in these states is having someone compelling, share it in a compelling way. So I'm all for people standing up and speaking out in all of these states, even when they're hard to win. So hats off to Beto, hats off to anybody in any state where this kind of work is really tough who's taking a swing at it.
Well, it used to be Mexico, so I'm guessing that if you can change country, you can change political party, hopefully.
You know what this is making me think about? I remember one time, Rowan, I think maybe in BYB, you were, I think, teaching a lesson about how all events are neutral and how we all, you know, bring our own everything to them. You talked about, like, if I asked you to make an argument that human beings are, like, the greatest creatures of all time, most benevolent, wonderful, amazing, like, you know, progressive creatures, could you make that argument? Of course you could. Yeah, could you make the argument that they're the worst fucking thing that could possibly happen to each other and the planet, that they're just like complete monsters, pieces of shit, and they're just going to destroy themselves and each other? You can make that too. Like, you, it's totally up to you the way you want to see the world. And I think right now it's interesting because there's sort of two things you have to hold in your head. One is what we were just talking about, how, like, we do live in the best age ever of anything. Mm-hmm. But also, I feel like the rhetoric, especially of like my generation, is like everything is a dumpster fire. Everything is trash. Look at this. Like, the fucking world is falling apart. Look at this news story. Look at that news story. I can't believe we're here again, which is also true to a degree. But like, there's a way where you can fully, I think when you're talking about, you could kind of just create one or the other extreme opinion of human nature. I see a lot of people living in the extreme of we're the worst fucking things of all time and everything mm-hmm. is shit. And it's not that these specific instances that we're looking at aren't terrible, but it's like, it almost feels like when someone goes like, but wait, there are some good things. Everyone's like, how dare you? How dare you speak about that right now? Which I get sometimes, because it's like, you know, you need to have reverence for, you know, times of grief and all that stuff. But it's how do you like hold both in your head in a very balanced way? Because I feel like a lot of people don't.
Comfortable being uncomfortable in today's world. Like, there's a lot in what you just opened up. So, the first thing that I want to say is, yes, that's a distinction that I use in BYB a lot. And the reason I use that distinction, telling people, could you prove that human beings are the best thing that ever happened to the world? Yes. Could you prove that human beings are the worst thing that ever happened to the world? Yes. Like the reason we say that is so that we can ask this question to people. If we can agree that there's evidence for whatever you want to be right about, then let's stop talking about the evidence and let's start talking why you want to be right about that.
Yeah.
Because it has nothing to do with the content that people use to argue. It has to do with their psychological need to prove something and then just creating arguments. This is the reason why when people argue, no one changes their mind, because no one's being truthful about why they want to be right about this and one day why they need with the world to look a certain way because of their beliefs and their trauma. They just fall in love with the argument and they are willing to contradict themselves in the next thing they say.
One other point about just the way that we're thinking about good times, bad times, all of that stuff. Because yes, this is in many ways, this is objectively the best time to be alive in human history. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has a project called Goalkeepers that they send out every year, where they track a ton of metrics like hunger, education, gender equity, stuff like that, that sort of lay out the ways in which things are getting better around the world. And in enormous way, exciting ways, this is an extraordinary time to be a human being on planet Earth, or to be born on planet Earth. This is incredible. And I think one of the things that one of the ways that I try to think about this sort of dichotomy about like things are great, but also things are terrible is I think that we, one of the challenges that we have is that we're capable of so much good, and we know that, and we're seeing it. We see all these good things happening. We know the capacity we have to do incredible things, and yet we still have these terrible, frustrating, horrible things happen. And I think there's a big sense of frustration that comes with that, that says like, oh, we know how to do this. We know how to do better. And yet it's not happening. And I think we see that with...
What's the why behind it, though? Why do you think that is? I completely agree with you. But why do you think that is?
Like why we're frustrated or why we don't take action?
Why in the middle of the best period in humanity, we still feel like everything's falling apart and we're shit?
I think part of it is really just that, I mean, I like to think that a lot of this is sort of an innate sense of optimism. This is why for me, it's like, I'm a Democrat and it's hard to be a Democrat or a progressive because we always think things can be better. It's really easy to say, even though we don't do it, it's easy to be like, things are great, don't touch anything. It requires zero work. But if you are like me, a progressive, a liberal, someone who says like things can be better than they are now, that is automatically telling people, hey, I need you to do something. I need you to work at something. I need you to take some kind of an action. Like, not only do I think that things aren't so great or could be better, but I think like you need to do something. I'm calling you to action. I'm requiring you to do something. That's way harder. And so it's like a two-part argument that says like, things aren't so hot. We have the capacity to do better, and we should. So a few different parts of this, and like here are all the ways that we need to accomplish that. But I like to think that it's a really optimistic way of looking at the world, because it's like, look at all the good we're capable of. Look at all the good we have done. Look at all the good we're doing right now, at all the ways things are getting better, at all the ways we're succeeding and making life better for people, no matter where you're born and no matter who you are. And that's fantastic. And so given all that we're capable of achieving, man, isn't it frustrating that things aren't always as good as they could be? What if they could be better? What if we could make them better? What if we did the work to make them better? I think that kind of frustration, while sometimes damaging to, speaking of mental health, damaging to our mental health, is also really positive, because it pushes us to make things better. If we just walked around saying, things are good, things are better than they ever have been, isn't that wonderful? That's sort of a recipe for apathy. That's how everything falls apart. You're not pushing to make things better. You need to take care of yourself, obviously. Things can't always be, you can't always be a ball of frustration, and you need to take a step back. And that's why I think it's helpful that we're having this conversation about things actually objectively being really good for a lot of people in a lot of places, and objectively in many ways getting better. But I also think that sense of frustration can be really powerful and really positive.
Yeah, the thing is, like, this is the question for me, at least in my head. Why is it that it is so hard to convince people that we're factually, objectively, in the best period in humanity?
I think Teresa hit the nail on the head in the comments because people want to have the victim mindset. Because they say, well, if things aren't perfect, or they all we look around is we see like the bad things, we don't want to give credit. We don't want to cede any ground to say like, okay, it's good, because then we're worried that people will say, well, then shut the fuck up.
I think that's true, but I think that's a symptom, not the problem.
Okay.
So I actually think that the part of the reason that we're not looking around and saying, wow, things are amazing, is that we also face a lot of challenges, and the challenges are immediate. The challenges are immediate in our own lives, and they're painful. And whether that means like it's more expensive to fill up my car with gas than it used to be, and that like has an impact on my life, or whether it's, you know, I need to be able to feed my family, and that's challenging. There are like daily hardships that come along that are different from, you know, these sort of long-term trends or big good things. Everything is still difficult. Like, life is still hard. And there are lots of things that we have to do every day in order to grow and succeed and make things better. In a big way, if you take a big step back and look at the world, for sure, things are better than they ever have been. But the people who are alive now didn't get dropped into this era after being born 50 years ago or a century ago. You know, we're experiencing this over time. And so rather than experiencing those gigantic steps forward in how we live and how we succeed, we're instead experiencing the sort of trials and tribulations of getting along in daily life. And in many ways, people are still very much struggling. And those sort of pain points are very immediate.
I love what you're saying, but isn't it mind-blowing that I agree with what you're saying, and if I had been born 100 years ago, then I would have like way more specific evidence of what I saw 100 years ago and what I see now. But then I can also take that argument and say, yeah, but people back then suffered way more. We're not exposed to the daily problem. Like, now I need to pay more to fill up my gas tank is very different from every five kids I have, three will probably make it. Like, it's a very different world, and they weren't victims
know,
as much
man.
As we
That's,
are.
They're pretty equal to me. Gas prices now. I'd rather fucking lose a kid, honestly.
We're operating on a different scale. That's the thing. It's like, the scale used to be very different. It used to be, as you say, you know, out of every five, we'll see who makes it. And now it's like, oh, I have to, you know, I have to do all these, like, daily frustrating things that I have to do.
Well, if I were
yeah,
to
it used to be like, two of the five won't make it. Now it's like two of the five might not get into this private school.
Yeah,
exactly. I'm suffering more.
But to be clear, and I like, there are lots of ways in which people are like really struggling, really hurting, not just around the world, but also in the United States.
Yeah,
whether that's from, I know, and like not to drop this on everybody, and just to do the like, remember that things are bad. But you know, obviously there are lots of people in this country who, you know, get in their car and go to work and worry that they might not come home at the end of the day, whether because of, you know, racial biases or because of prejudices of another kind or because they face like some kind of dangerous situation. There are lots of ways that we are not holding up our end in making life in this country all that it should be. And again, I come at that from a very positive place of like, we should be doing better. We have the ability to do better. I know that we can do better. And so that's where, to me, the frustration comes. And that's why I think we get focused on the hardships over the positive stuff. That's the stuff that at least for me, it comes with a big healthy dose of frustration that I know we can do better. And yet, you know, we're just not moving as fast or as effectively or always in the right direction that I think we should.
I have a theory that I want to offer. I just don't think that the well-being of the most, like the largest group of people possible in humanity is just not compatible with how we're building like human beings and identities. And what I believe is this, the reason we cannot enjoy and convince other human beings of factual information about how we really are at the best stage humanity has ever had is because happy people are not good consumers.
Really? So go on, say more.
Yeah, for sure. Like, we live in a capitalist world, most of it, and nothing sells like fear. Nothing.
Yes.
Oh, I see.
Well, just like the way that human beings are programmed. It's like people take more action. Who wrote about this? It was in Never Split the Difference. People are more likely to take action to avoid loss than they are to maximize gain.
Yep. It's
That's how our news industry is built. It's all fear. Yeah. You know, is this mold killing you in your house? Tune in at 10, you know, versus like, here's a way to make $500. Tune in at 10. People are going to be like, I'm going to tune in to see if I'm dying versus make an extra $500.
I don't know. $500 one sounds pretty good, too.
Yeah.
And I actually think that it's an evolutionary problem. Like, not even a people in power problem, but a human evolutionary problem. It's the negativity bias in our head. Like, the reason humanity survived, and we know this historically and sociologically and psychologically, the reason humanity survived, one of the most important reasons, is negativity bias. We pay more attention to the things that are dangerous, to the things that are bad, than to the things that are positive. And that allowed us to survive. Like, our brain pays more attention to dangers, fears, and problems than to positive things. I always tell people, if you go out one morning wearing a new shirt, and 10 people tell you that you look amazing, and one of them tells you that you look a little bit fat, which one do you remember?
I mean, try being on YouTube and looking at comments. It's the same thing.
Also, I've never had 10 people tell me I look great in one day. That sounds 9 out of 10.
Comment section? You want to get on that?
Light it up, fellas.
You're choosing the wrong friends, Jake. Hang out with us more.
Let's talk about Jake for a hot second because we, you know, this isn't what we promised. Well, we do talk about biotypes on the podcast.
I think we biotyped Jake back in the day.
We didn't do it, but not on the podcast or for the listening audience. And now that Rodrigo's had some time to like really talk and reflect, I'm curious if the read stands. A year ago, I had like a Zoom call with some friends and just trying to connect the most interesting people I know. And of course, everyone, you know, on this screen right now, on this podcast right now, was invited.
Except for Brian.
I know. Brian, I asked why. No, you were like, you're too uninteresting. You texted me that over and over and over again.
I remember
and
that,
you
yeah.
didn't respond.
For weeks.
So, yeah. I
still get some of those messages every once in a while.
You texted Ro and me every day.
I did it in a group chat. Yeah. I was just like, Ro, watch this. And I swung for the fences.
Brian's just not interesting enough.
But the original read on Jake. So my original read on Jake is I thought he was melancholic. I thought he was like a bit of a promoting melancholic.
No,
and then
he's
Rodrigo
not.
Throws this curveball at me and tells me that Jake is my secret choleric.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, I would have guessed that too.
You would have guessed that?
Definitely.
Is he promoting or analyzing?
I think he's somewhere between promoting and supporting.
Okay, that tracks.
I just appreciate that Ross comes in here with an idea and you guys are like, look, you big dumb dummy.
That's our dynamic.
And at the same time, we all know that when it comes to reading people from our lives, usually the person that knows them is the one that sucks. Like, I'm the expert in this and I misread my needs like for 10 years.
I don't have a ton of cholerics that I get along with, which is surprising because I adore the hell out of Jake. He's so funny. But I guess that can kind of come from the promoting side of things. But he also doesn't strike me as someone that's like overbearing with his power. Basically, Jake, what I'm saying is, when are you going to run for office?
Yeah, but Jake clearly has a power and a forcefulness in every sentence he says. Like, it's very choleric the way
like
Jake
there's
speaks.
Something very interesting about you, Jake, and it's the following. The way you can use the stubbornness of being choleric in a productive, friendly, loving way is pretty like admirable.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Like most people from your biotype are never able to like master their strength in a way to be productive in what they really care about in life. So that's pretty mind blowing.
I think you're able to argue effectively without putting people in a defensive mode. I think that's probably a really that's probably gotten you places that other clerics haven't been able to get to a lot when you because other clerics can do things where people are like, oh, all right, I'll fucking stop arguing. Jesus, like your point is clear. Fine. But like that's not the way you argue at all. And yet you still make your point very clear and articulately.
Are you guys ready for the big curveball that might explain this about Jake?
Before the curveball, I want to say something.
Okay.
I guess what's really exciting about meeting someone like you, Jake, is that you either weren't exposed to something growing up, or you created an extremely positive, like, cognitive outcome from those situations because you're not afraid of how powerful you are. And most clerics are. Like, most people from your biotype, we just had a dinner party with a bunch of people, and I was literally explaining to clerics how we treat them and what has happened with the image of what being a cleric in society now means. And this cleric guy came up to me and he said, I know the exact moment in which my strength started to be seen as hostility and aggression towards other human beings, and I had to change who I am. And that's how most clerics actually feel in the States, like from what I've encountered and been able to like see and interact with. You're an odd one out from that like group of clerics. Like if you weren't exposed to women victimizing, like women like paying the price of like really strong clerics being oppressive in a way, or you just explained it to yourself in a way that actually allows you to use all of your power without being afraid of it. And that's pretty cool.
Thank you.
Are we ready for the Jake curveball?
Yes,
this is gonna
I'm excited
exactly
for the Jake curveball. I don't
said.
Know where this is headed.
You yeah, don't know the Jake curveball?
No. I'm worried I'm going to find out something about myself.
Yeah.
Well, to it's Jake a British is... ball because it's a Jake ball.
What'd you call it?
A British ball.
That's exactly what it is. So the curveball is that Jake grew up. No. Jake grew up in England. So his culture.
He wasn't exposed to that culture. That makes sense.
When did you come over here, Jake? How old were you?
Oh no, I was born here, but I was born in the U.S. But I will say too, not to throw a wrench in your curveball. If you want to just mix metaphors all over the place,
it's a wrench ball.
It's a wrench ball. To throw you a wrench ball.
She gets to go to a baseball game where a guy threw a wrench at her. It's crazy.
I'm pretty sure that's illegal.
So to throw you a wrench ball, I also when I was in the UK, I went to an international school. So it was an American school with American curriculum, but with sort of populations from around the world. I think it was about 40% American when I showed up, but most of the teachers, most of the vibe, and then the curriculum were American. So I don't know if that busts up your expectations. I will say, I mean, I think anybody who has lived abroad will recognize like a certain amount of like out of placeness. Yeah. Especially, you know, I grew up in a community where, you know, it was an international community. If you go into, if you're a kid from, you know, my high school and go into London, it's very clear when you open your mouth that you are not from London.
How old were you when you went abroad?
3 years old.
Okay. And when did you come back to the States?
I came back for college. But I came back.
That means that all of your beliefs and your identity were created in the UK.
That's
literally
what I was saying. Yeah. Yeah.
But. Also created in a community that was much more skewed, that was very, not skewed, but very much made up of Americans and also international kids. So a little bit, I wouldn't say that my experiences come from, for example, like I didn't grow up in the same way that a kid growing up in London would grow up or a kid growing up in another part of the UK would grow up. You know, again, if I go into London, it's clear I'm not from there. Similarly, if, you know, when I come to the US, it's way easier for me to be a kid from the US. If you ask me where I'm from now, I'll tell you, I live, you know, I'm in DC. And that's where I was born. And so, it's a little bit of a messy mix.
Psychologically, it does explain a lot about you. I'll give you an example. The reason I speak English is because I went to a British school in Mexico. Half of my classmates were British, like the other half were from all over. And what that gives you is perspective, and it makes you not fundamental about your worldview. Because when you're in a country where everybody around you, in school, in your family, on the street, agrees on certain things, then your views will be extremely fundamental and you'll never develop the ability to actually challenge your views. But going to a British school, I knew that certain values from the school weren't exactly the same as on the street. And that gave me perspective. And that gave me people that had completely different viewpoints about what life is, what love is, what relationships are, what a family is. And that makes you question things in a completely new way. And that's, like, you should be thankful of that, my friend. Like,
oh, for sure.
It allowed you to be you, yeah.
For sure. And look, I had a really valuable experience living overseas. And I think you're right in talking about perspective, particularly. I think when I came from a community where it was made very clear to me very early on that people come from all sorts of places, and that doesn't make, it's sort of like there's no one person or one place that is like the protagonist of the story. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes things a little bit, that made me much more willing, not even just willing to see another person's point of view, but interested in seeing another person's point of view.
Not threatened by them. I feel like that's the key. You don't feel threatened by them when you have perspective. You find them interesting and you want to understand why do you think like that? And what are your values and what do you stand for? And that allows you to like review your own ideology and change it when it's necessary. Like people that have those types of perspective and experiences in life are willing to burn the books way faster than everyone else. And by burning the books, it's like, if this was the truth, I'm ready to create a new one. Like if it doesn't serve me anymore, I'm willing to transform my ideology because of the like final objective and the world that I want to create. And that's what most people from first world countries never experience. And I can say this, like my mom's Spanish, half of my family's over there. And because they're from Spain and because they're European, they're extremely fundamental about their worldviews. I've mentioned this in the past. I have family in Spain that has never visited France. And like, it's closer to go to France from Spain than to visit my wife's city, like where she was born within Mexico.
We dug deep on Jake, which is great.
We love you, Jake.
Yes. Jake is one of my favorite people on the planet. And just very excited for you to run for office one day, which is when?
Are you looking to get into?
So when I was a kid, I'll say this. When I was a kid, I was really interested in running for office because I felt like that was sort of the best way for – I felt like it was – again, sort of coming from this place of like optimism and energy and like not a little bit of frustration, I felt like there was an opportunity to do some real good through just kind of running for office, getting your hands dirty, getting involved in something. And I think over time, I have ended up doing a lot of stuff that's behind the scenes, or at least behind the scenes makes it sound shady, but more just like that is out of the spotlight. And that has involved policy work. It's involved speech writing and communications, helping people communicate ideas effectively, which is something I do think is really important. I have felt for a long time, it's harder now, but that if you can communicate an idea effectively, like if an idea is a good idea and you can communicate it effectively, people will find ways to bring that idea forward. People will be convinced of a good idea if it is communicated effectively. It's hard to do. It doesn't always work, but that's sort of something that really drove me in communications. I think as time has gone on, I've become maybe not less interested in running for office, but more aware of the realities around running for office, which is that it's really hard and you have to really be, the moment has to be right. And I mean, I live in DC. We don't have quite as many opportunities for elective office as most other places in the United States. As you may have heard, we do not have voting congressional representation. We don't have senators. We have a delegate instead of a member of Congress, Eleanor Holmes Norton, who can't vote in Congress. And that is entirely
because DC isn't like legally a part of the states, right?
Well, it's a district, but it's not a state. And so as a result, we don't have voting representation. It's why there are, 100 senators and not 102. And the reason that there's not 102 senators is that Republicans in the United States Senate and in Congress more generally don't like the idea of Washington, D.C., which is, I think, still a majority Black city and extremely Democratic in political view, electing two more senators. If there were two more Democratic senators right now, like you could kick Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema to the curb and pass whatever you wanted by reconciliation, and we would have passed, you know, Build Back Better in its original form. We would have done, like, there's all sorts of stuff you can do with 52 like Democratic senators who are committed to, or 50 Democratic senators who are committed to liberal policies all the time. Now, from my perspective, it would be great for DC to have representation, not just because of what they could do in Congress or the Senate, but because it's the right thing to do. The United Nations has said that it's a human rights violation that DC doesn't have voting representation.
It is.
Isn't it ironic that they have taxation without representation in the nation's capital?
It's on our license plates.
It says taxation without no taxation.
It says no taxation without representation. That's on the DC license plate. Yes.
That's hysterical. That's like a Mike Judge joke.
When President Obama was president, he switched out the DC license plate on the Beast, which is like the presidential limousine, to be that DC license plate. So this is like a real thing. I mean, I know we just took a little detour from like would I ever run to office to like, boy, isn't it terrible that DC doesn't have voting representation? But if I can like get people jazzed about DC voting representation, then like, I will talk for as long as you want about this.
Why was it built like that, though? Because there's a lot of why was it built like that? Because there's a lot of conspiracy theories about it.
What some folks will tell you is that DC was never meant to be a place where people lived. There are a few different reasons. There are a few different reasons why, like, that at the time it may have made sense. And part of that is like, well, you don't want you don't want the seat of government to be in its own place because it'll be too powerful. You don't want it to be part of another state because that state will be too powerful. There were issues of jurisdiction. There were issues of security, all this stuff. Some people now will tell you that it was never meant to be a place where a lot of people live. That is false. In fact, Pierre L'Enfant, who designed DC as a city, planned it to be a city of like 1 million people. He set out a plan for a city of 1 million people. Right now, we have 700,000 people in the District of Columbia and more who come in to work there from Maryland, Virginia. So that's 700,000 people who live within the District of Columbia and have no voting representation and are represented only by a Congress that they cannot vote for.
Wow. That's crazy.
Wow.
It is crazy. It's totally crazy. And the only way that changes is, first of all, like, it's not hard mechanically. Basically, you need 50 senators, like with the tiebreaker, to decide, and the House to decide that it's going to be a state and to break a filibuster, like to put the filibuster aside and then say it's a majority vote. Like, this doesn't require an amendment. It doesn't require like 2/3 of states to agree to something. This is like up and down vote. Should DC be a state with voting representation? And the answer is yes. Now, the only way that becomes possible, first of all, you need the people to do it, but we actually have like we have the numbers. You would need to set aside the filibuster, which has caused more harm than good, especially recently, but also in the past. And then you just need the will to do it. This becomes like a back burner issue anytime like there's an opportunity to do it, because people are like, well, it's like, it feels like a power grab. It's like not something that we should do. In reality, it's just giving voting representation to 700,000 people in the United States who do not have the right to vote for a representative who can represent them. That's it. We have no right to vote on issues of gun violence, even though gun violence impacts people in DC. We have no right to vote on issues of national education, even though absolutely education affects the people in DC. We have no right to vote on national issues of abortion, even though plenty of people in DC need abortions or just need reproductive care. There are all of these issues that impact everybody across the United States every single day, and we have no ability to call our member of Congress and have them write a bill that they can vote on. So this is sort of where we're at. So what I would ask people who listen to this podcast, and people who are friends of people who listen to this podcast, anybody you know, is please do make this something that you care about. because it actually makes a huge difference, not just for the people in DC, but for people across the country who don't have the kind of representation that we need and can provide. Right now, everything in the Senate, everything is in Congress is skewed toward one party. Part of that is because of gerrymandering. It's also because, and the Senate is like way skewed towards plain states and states that are and agricultural states and things like that. And that's sort of how it's been from the beginning. We have two Dakotas. We have like, you know, there's, but we need representation of all of the people in this country. And that includes the people in DC. So I urge you to care about this issue. And if you have a Democratic senator who in theory should also care about this, and has no reason not to care about this, then please do make this something that you talk to your senator about. Please do make it something that you talk to your member of Congress about. If you have a Republican one, do that too.
Okay, so this brings up something really big for me. Just, I'm so tired of caring when it feels when it feels so helpless to do so. Like, my mom writes a lot of letters, and I'm like, if it makes you feel better, go for it. But to me, everything feels so hopeless, and it doesn't matter what I do or who I call. If I call, like, what the hell is my phone call going to do or my email going to do when it's just going to go to some aide in their office or some intern, and they're not going to do what I care about. My representative is just going to do whatever the people who write them the checks, the corporate funders do.
Whoever paid for their campaign.
So, like, this brings up a bigger issue, I guess, Jake. Like, I have exhaustion around empathy. Like, I'm cared out. Like, I care about, like, my heart breaks when I hear about these shootings, but I feel like, well, we're fucked. Like, there's nothing I can do as an individual, because whatever I do is just going to be, you know, like, just such a nothing burger in the grand scheme of things.
So I get it. Like, believe me, as a person who cares about this stuff, all of this stuff very deeply, and is like more often than not on the losing end of progress. like 100%
for a memoir, The Losing End of Progress.
The Losing End of Progress. 100%, I get it. I think sometimes one helpful way to think about this that I feel like popped up on some timeline or in some conversation one time or another is that a lot of this is, it's about kind of caring about this stuff or taking action about any of this stuff is a little bit like buying a bus ticket that's headed toward your destination. It's not going to take you all the way there, and there may still be a lot to go, but it's sort of, it's heading in the right direction. It's pointing you the right way. And that's really important. The biggest thing that I can tell you is just, you have to care about it, because if you don't, that's awful. And like, things will get bad. And this is maybe me also doing the same
thing. Using the fear thing.
I know, I'm doing the fear thing. But we can do this in a positive way too, that like, things do really change. If you look, and we look at that in the broad scheme of things, the way that we were just talking about how things are better now than they ever have been in the broad strokes ways. And that didn't happen because it didn't happen all at once. And it didn't happen, you know, because one person made a decision or anything like that. It happens sort of through these like grinded out victories. It happens because a movement meets a moment and things start to shift. And so part of the reason, I know someone asked like, what can you do about DC statehood, all that kind of stuff. And it's the same, I mean, for DC statehood, there's like particular things you can do, whether that means getting involved with like an actual DC statehood organization, or just making this something that representatives in your community have to be for or have to answer about. Right now, it's really easy for people to say like, that's not my issue. If you live outside DC, it's really easy for your member of Congress, who does get a vote in Congress, to say, it's not an issue for my constituents because I don't represent DC. Sure, nobody does. But if people in enough places say, hey, this is an issue I care about, and if you are going to get my vote in a primary even, because we're plenty gerrymandered in districts, but in a primary even, this is an issue you have to be for, DC statehood, you have to be for in order to get my vote. If enough people have that mentality, it requires people to actually have a position on this issue. And there is no defensible position against this issue. So make people get on the record, make them be interested. And then if you have enough people get into a position of power who have stated this view and have said that they're for it, that will require them to actually take the action that they've said that they'll take. So it's a long game, for sure. And that's true of a lot of the things we care about. It's a long game. And you have to take care of yourself. You have to surround yourself at times with people who are going to take care of you and who are going to support you. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't care about this stuff. It means you can take a break. You can take a breather. But also, you know, if it helps, I'm here for you. I'm here for all of you folks who are struggling here, because I get it. I have struggled too.
Do you mean it?
I do mean it.
Say your phone number. Say your phone number out loud.
So my phone number is 555.
Wait a minute.
555.
Okay, I have something to say about this, and I promise we'll bring it back to you, Ross, and what you were saying, because it's important. But the one thing is, there is like a reason to be against like the District of Columbia becoming a state. There is a reason. And I know, like, I promise I'm not wearing a tin hat, but the way we see it from the outside is like this. It's something that you learned from the British, and we tried it too. Mexico tried it too. We just changed it a few years ago, like no more than 5 years ago. Mexico City was a district that was not a state. It was called the Federal District. And the reason you do that is to have an unregulated space in which you can do something without supervision. That's why London has London within it. The square, like the square mile city, the city of London, that has nothing to do with England or the UK or like anything like that. And it's a financial district that it's actually there to protect banks. That's why you do it. Like you take representation from them because you want an unsurveilled space. What is it for, though? Because those are the interests holding it up.
So that I'll say, though, like, even if that's like the even if that's your perspective, turning DC into a state actually doesn't impact the places where like where federal policy is made or anything like that. Like, you know, because the way that you would do it, and there's a proposal that DC pushed that would make DC it would be Douglas Commonwealth, and the areas you could make the federal areas like Congress and the White House and places like that, and places that are currently now like federally mm-hmm. controlled, those could all be still federal areas outside of the control of Douglas Commonwealth, which would be the place that people actually live in DC. So there are ways to create a federal district like within DC that can still be, you know, that can still be a place of like national coming together and national control, but the places outside the area outside of those federal buildings or federal monuments or that kind of stuff, then all of that is controlled, would be controlled by Douglas Commonwealth, DC, the state of DC.
Yes. But what I mean is what we're fighting against. Like what I mean is in the same way I say why we're suffering in a world where we've never been better, has to do with certain interests. And unless we pay attention to those and we know what we're fighting against, because we know that the city of London is there to take care of financial interests. What is DC there for? I can tell you what people say, but I have no evidence of it whatsoever. Like London is supposed to be the financial capital of the world, and Washington DC is supposed to be the military capital of the world. And that the decisions made about finances are the ones that uphold London, and decisions made in military are the ones that uphold the space that DC is today. I don't know if that's true. I'm just saying that given what we know of London, like, is that what we're fighting against? Because I don't see why anyone would ever want to create a space in which people don't have representation.
It's well, he kind of pointed out earlier where it's like it would give a more predominantly democratic area more representation, which would tip the scales away from the Republicans.
Yeah, but that's not as old as this. Like that makes sense today. Why was it created though?
So I mean, initially, like I said, there were a few different reasons. Some of them are about like you don't want one area to have control of the seat of federal government.
Yeah.
Like
no, I understand that argument,
that makes people nervous, and I get that. But over time, it is just that. Once people are really hesitant to give up power, and that's what we're dealing with here. Like I mean, honestly, I'm surprised that like DC has three electoral votes. I am like blown away that that is something that we ever got to do. But there have been attempts to make DC a state, or at least to give DC representation. One of them, I think there was one in like the 1970s. I think Birch Bayh was a big fan of this stuff. So there have been attempts over time, but they've never gotten across the finish line to get DC representation. There was one also recently, or more recently, that wasn't even about making DC a state or giving us senators, but was just about us getting a voting representative in Congress. Mm. And the plan was basically that DC would get a member of Congress, voting member of Congress, and in return, basically, so that we could maintain balance, the state of Utah would get another member of Congress. And there are reasons for that. And it was basically that, like, in the previous census, when they were doing redistricting, Utah came really close to getting another district and didn't quite. And so the idea was, well, it's pretty close. Let's give him another one. It'll end up being a pretty reliably Republican seat, and DC will be a reliably Democratic seat. And that way there's no real shift in power. That started making its way through Congress. And then Republicans attached an amendment that basically said that if this bill passed, that it would also strip all of DC's firearm regulations away from DC. So basically, like, DC has had some pretty stringent rules about firearms, about guns. And
was that the NRA funded members of the Republican Party? Because that seems like
as opposed to the other ones.
Bazinga.
Ryan, you're a Republican, right?
Yes, super. I live my life just like a Republican.
Put that gun down, Brian.
I think I'm like, I think when a Republican like imagines like a liberal nightmare, they think of me. They think of like my bedroom, my lifestyle, all of it.
Dude, you're never in the same room for every episode.
I know. And I'm just like, I was like, you know, traipsing around with my artistic like friends who are literal fairies in the forest. I'm like, okay, this is.
But I love that you take us all through the world with your amazing stories and places. Like having you in Switzerland in the middle of an episode and then in a castle in Scotland.
Oh, yeah. That was great.
That was amazing.
I have stories for you guys off mic about that later.
Oh. Uh-huh.
But anyway, we've derailed immensely from what we were just talking about. I was going to say, first of all, I was going to say, Jake, you just should be a politician. You speak very clearly about all these things in a way that I'm like, whoa, I don't understand.
I would vote for you.
That's big.
No matter what you say, I'll vote for you. I was thinking about this empathy exhaustion you were talking about, Ross. And I was thinking about, like, that's something when we talk about people being like, the world's shit and everything's terrible. It's like, yeah, but, you know, there are 7 billion people on this planet. There's so much bad shit happening all the time to everybody that if you really think about it, you can spend 0% of your life having a good time because you're constantly thinking about how terrible. So you can like divert your focus to it. And sometimes I'm like, I think to be healthy, you have to say, and I say this in like a loving way, I'm not going to care for a bit. I'm not going to care for a time. I'm not going to care about this issue. I'm not going to care. I should, but I just don't have the bandwidth. I think there must be, but then it feels crazy to be like, well, how can I say I don't care about this? How can I not take action? Well, because I take action about these things, and this is my kind of journey, and I need space to not have like a happy day where I don't think about any of that stuff, because if you don't make that space for yourself, what's the fucking point of living? So it's like, where do you draw that line? And it's crazy. But I do think that like I've seen a lot of people be like, no, I've got to feel about everything, like every injustice I got to feel. And it's like, that's sounds very noble, but I think it's literally impossible. And then you make yourself burn out and then you can't do anything. So I think that's, you know, and I bet phlegmatics have a very hard time with that, Ross.
That was very insightful.
This is sort of the the idea that if you're on an airplane and it goes into turbulence, you have to put your own mask on first.
Yeah.
So you can help others. And I think that's sort of worth keeping in mind. I think you're exactly right. I think it's and Ross, I think what you said is exactly right. It's really hard to care all the time. And it's really easy to burn out. And some of that is, again, this sort of frustration born of optimism.
Well,
but
the thing is, like, it seems solvable. It seems pretty obvious what needs to be done to solve it. And it just, like, is really frustrating to see it not being... Like, I get it. There are some really complex problems. But there are also some that are pretty fucking simple.
Like, whoa. Let's not sell guns.
Yeah. Or, like, yeah, yeah. But even just, like, if it's... Look, we're going to give extensive background checks, and it's a federal law that if you want a weapon, like, it should not be easier for a citizen to get a weapon than a police officer. Like, yeah. Police officers have to go through training about this. I think The Daily Show did a really excellent example about how easy it is to get a concealed carry permit, because all you have to do is mail something into Florida, take 8 hours of training, and then you're good to get a gun.
I remember that episode.
Yeah. So it's just like, it's just, like I said, this, they call it common sense gun reform, where it's just like, this is really fucking easy. We're not going to take your fucking guns. We're just going to make sure that if you get it, you're not going to be a dick with it. You're just going to be like a normal, like, if I want to drive a car, I get to have a license. You know, I get to take a test. I get to do check-ins on that test. If I want global entry into different countries every 5 years or whatever, they go ahead and say, hey, we're just checking in and making sure that you didn't become a felon in the past X amount of time, you know? It just makes total sense. And then I look and I see it's just like, I whenever I look at like the big problems, I go, well, this is all tied back to money and politics. This all ties back to Citizens United. I think Colbert did an excellent job showing the dangers of what super PACs are able to do in terms of funneling dark money in. And I'm just like, it's those things, like, where I'm just like, can't we just... And I get really frustrated at people, because I'm like, you know, you're the sucker here, right? You know, they don't represent you. They like, you're the thing that bought what they're selling hook, line, and sinker.
It's the money.
Yeah.
So a couple of things. One is just, if I may, when I just wanted to make one point about when we say, you know, we're not trying to take your guns away. We're just trying to make sure that you're not going to be a dick about it. But it's not just like us saying, I think it's useful to make clear that it's not just us saying like, hey, we're going to make sure that you, the person who wants the gun, go through a background check, da, da, da. It's also like, we're making sure, like, look, we know, I'm sure you're cool. I'm sure you're fine. But the other people out there who are like not as responsible as you are, like, you know who these people are. So like, don't you want everyone who owns a gun to be as responsible as you are? Absolutely. Like, that's, you know, there's also there's a certain amount of, I'm sure you're fine, but also like, let's make sure that other folks are doing the right thing too, because there's a lot of people out there. That's sort of thing one, and now I'm blanking on what thing two was.
He's so good. Isn't he good, Rodrigo, the way in which he speaks?
Well, except that I lost my train of thought like halfway
through. Doesn't matter. I was just thinking about, like,
you chose the one moment.
Attention. You lost your train of thought, and we're still listening and just waiting for you to get it back.
Here it is. Thank you for vamping for a little while, but I got it. So the other thing I was going to say is, one thing that can be really helpful, we spend a lot of time thinking about national policy, right? That's the big stuff. That's the stuff that takes up a lot of brain space. It's also the stuff over which we have the least control. And that can cause a lot of frustration and a lot of burnout. I encourage people to get, it sounds really hokey, but I really encourage people to get involved in local politics, not just because it's close to you, which it is, not just because it has a huge impact on your daily life, which it does, but also because, especially at a time when the Supreme Court, when federal powers are really devolving a lot of stuff to local or state entities, it's a great way to actually create change. So, for example, when we talk about Roe versus Wade, and we talk about the Supreme Court's leaked opinion that suggested that Roe versus Wade could go by the wayside. What happens then in a lot of instances is that all of these all of the rules around abortion basically devolved down to state rules, state laws, which is why all these states are trying to implement laws that prevent people from getting abortions in their state. So what that means is if you are in any state around the country, your state, whatever your state's rule is, state rules on abortion, that's basically what's coming. So do some work at the local level, at the state level, to make decisions around what your state is going to do with regard to a woman's right to choose, a woman's right to get health care, anybody's right to get appropriate, necessary care for themselves. This is a place you can actually make a huge difference at the state level, because that's where all of this ends up. So spend time, that this is sort of my other advice for like burnout, is really dial back to your state, to your community, and find ways that you can make a tangible difference. It is not only hugely rewarding, but it's actually hugely impactful. And the people who you elect at the state level, or even at the, you know, as state representatives, as state senators, as mayors, all of this stuff, these are folks who will not only make policy for your local community, but will also be the candidates, presumably or potentially, for higher office in the future. So you're not only like changing the way that things work in your state and creating policy that could end up being like the determinative policy on issues like abortion, on issues of healthcare or guns or any of this stuff, but you're also setting up a bunch of people who will step up and do this at a higher level next. So if you're looking for a place to spend your time and energy and resources where it feels like you're actually making an impact, I would encourage you to go local.
Kim Kardashian tweeted out her support.
Ah, finally, we're getting to the
Rick
good stuff.
Caruso. So I'm saying, like, even, I guess, it, you know, for people listening, it might be a little easier on a local level. But I mean, like, here in Los Angeles, we're still playing with the biggest fish in the fucking world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you guys got a big state, for yeah. sure.
Yeah.
But you do have two senators, and so I envy you.
Yeah, and they're all, you know, Rick Caruso has the Latino edge just because he is. And this is where identity politics starts to come back in as well, yep. because people are going to be like, oh, like he's Mexican or he's Latino, so I'm going to vote for him, even though his policies are probably really terrible for the Latino, with the majority of the Latino community out here. Oh, Jake, when are you running, my friend?
Because 2024.
Get me a like Senate seat or a congressional seat in DC and watch me run. No, I mean, I'm not from anywhere is sort of part of it. Like I'm not from anywhere that, unless I like ran for like DC City Council, which is a good group of folks doing the Lord's work. It's, you know, DC is a tough place to be in politics, but also very important. I don't have any plans right now to run for anything. I've always said, like, if there was an opportunity, if there was an opportunity where I felt like I could make an impact in a positive way as a candidate, I would totally do that.
Please move to California. We need you in Southern California.
You got tons. You got millions of people in California. You can't find one there.
Wait, Russ, I have something way better than that. Jake, okay. How's your Spanish? Do you want to be president of Mexico?
It's a trap. Don't do it.
I can probably make it happen.
I'll tell you what, I understand Spanish pretty well, but I speak it really slowly or not at all. And so I would mostly be the kind of president who like looks very thoughtful and like nods his head. So, which I think would make me very popular. But
so
without
mysterious.
Like,
yes.
I'd be very mysterious. People would be like, this guy really thinks hard about stuff.
You can always do what Ross does. He has perfect pronunciation, like in four phrases. And when he uses them, it sounds like he speaks Spanish.
Yeah. ¿Qué es cabrón? ¿Así guapo? Okay, all right.
What's cabrón?
He's like, you punk. Yeah.
It's asshole, but when used as Ross just used it, is like, dude.
Brian also worked with John Ossoff to get him elected. So I'm volunteering Brian.
Well done.
Thanks. It was fun. John I knew from childhood. It was.
Oh, that's amazing.
Oh, yeah. When he started running for that first seat in 2016, we were like, what? John's going to, no, this is ridiculous. And then watching that groundswell come from nothing to what he became was very surreal. I've seen it happen in the movie industry with my friends, but never in politics. It was very wild. And then I helped edit a bunch of videos for him when he got elected last
year. And now he owns a castle in Scotland.
And now John Ossoff owns a castle in Scotland?
No, I was talking about you.
Oh, me, yeah.
Okay. I was like, that's a weird remote restraint.
No.
I do own a castle in Scotland, yes.
If this was Mexican politics, it's like, oh, I supported my friend who's a governor now. I'm now in a state.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there is no underhanded, like, he didn't slip me any money or anything. I wanted him to, but...
asshole with integrity.
Bottle of red wine, does that count?
Yeah.
It's good enough.
Bribe.
Jake, just you're the best, and if I had to criticize you for one thing, which I know everyone's begging me to do
it, you son of a bitch.
Yeah, it would be that you don't visit enough, and you never call.
Oh. Yeah. Yes, that is true. That is true.
And he's not caring about it anymore because he can't care anymore.
Ross is absolutely right, and yeah. I actually did. I want you to know, Ross, and everybody else listening, if this does make it in, I want you to know, Ross, that I actually earlier today was looking at my calendar. I'm blocking off a section of time in October, as we discussed, to find a time to come out. So I also dislike myself for not visiting enough, but I'm trying to get better.
I love
it. Can we go?
Yes. Yeah. So Jake, when you're out, we'll schedule and we will all go get Italian food at Brian's favorite spot.
Yes.
Little Caesar's Pizza.
Pizza, baby. So authentic.
Yeah. Brian, I don't know if you know this about Jake, but Jake is, if he decided not to do politics, he would have made a brilliant writer on either like Saturday Night Live or Colbert. He has the comedy chops to be up there hitting with the big boys. So I'm excited.
I feel like you would have done even better than me at like SNL because those cold opens are so political and it's not really my forte, but I feel like you have like the insight to that world that a Colbert or like an SNL would want, which is great.
I really appreciate, I really like it when Ross says things about like this, my strengths, and then I don't have to prove it. That's like the best way for any of this to go.
That's what Ross does. It's great.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
Yeah.
He's like, this guy can dunk on a regulation hoop. And I'm like, I sure can.
I know. If there was one around, I'd show you. But I guess I will never know.
Wait for him
to start doing it the way he does it with me. Like, walking around with people and going like, do you want to hear five things that will blow your mind forever and are absolutely true? Bro, tell them.
I feel like the last end of this deal. He just goes around telling people I'm talented. And then I'm like, and then I just nod sagely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Rodrigo's skill is one that can be demonstrated. Brian, I do put him on the spot with his mime because that is something that can be demonstrated. But Jake, for you, it's more just like, oh, you should see the words that this guy has written in the past and already done. Oh. Yeah. There was one time.
If only you could see the things that this guy has done that are secret.
There was someone that ran for Senate in some state that didn't win, and I know you
checks
were
out
working.
So far.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
What?
Sounds like a guy I worked for.
I said there was a guy running for Senate in the state, and he didn't win. And Jake said, "Checks out so far." Like the story.
Yeah, but is that like saying, like, I know a guy whose pilot didn't get picked up? It's like, yeah, it sounds like someone I know.
Everyone. Well,
I think that applies to everyone, literally, yeah.
But I remember this moment because, like, Jake, he was reading out a concession speech. And I was, like, messaging you, and you said, I really wish you got to hear the other one. And I just thought that was a very nice way of saying, like, he had a really great victory speech planned as well. It reminds me like, you know, in politics, they've got two speeches ready to go, the one that they hope to give and the one that they hope they never have to. And like when Hillary lost in 2016, there was something that said like they took the confetti out of the cannons and put it back into the boxes, which is like,
oh, no.
Because she was so fully prepared to win. And like they had the confetti cannon set up. She had the space chosen where she was going to be speaking that had a literal glass ceiling. Like they were so ready.
Were they about to break the glass ceiling?
Yes.
Look, nobody wants to nobody wants to waste good confetti.
Yeah, and a bunch of interns had to go around popping all of the balloons. Like, there should just be a book, like a coffee table book, about like it's not Schadenfreude. Actually, it might be Schadenfreude, but just like the victory speeches or the parties that were thrown.
That'd be really fun, actually. I can actually point you to just such a book that was just written by a friend of mine called Jeff Nussbaum, and it's called Undelivered. And it is actually, so this is actually really interesting, and this doesn't have to be for the podcast or it can be if people are interested, but it's actually a really cool idea. But he went back and found all of these speeches that were like not things that people like thought about and considered, but like decision points where people actually wrote two different speeches and were like prepared to give either one. So there's like a speech for if like D-Day went badly. There was a speech for if the astronauts didn't come back. There's like,
yeah, Charlie said the moon one is nuts, like moon mission. Yeah,
so the and so so Jeff Nussbaum, who's a former speechwriter for a variety of folks, including most recently Joe Biden, he's written this incredible book where he actually went through and found all of these different moments where there was an alternate speech prepared, including like the Hillary victory speech and stuff like that, and kind of gives you the content, including like John Lewis's original intended speech at the March on Washington, which was much more aggressive, that he was sort of talked out of by Martin Luther King and others, because folks were concerned that if he gave the speech he was going to give, that it would sort of cause this fairly fragile coalition to fall apart. Wow. So
it's like the side B of the official history.
Yes. So, and it's like the context of all of these different speeches, and what people were thinking at the time and what went into them. Really, really interesting. So if folks are interested in something like that, it's called Undelivered by Jeff Nussbaum. And you can pick it up at a normal book place.
The opposite of that is, this reminded me, there is a Clickhole article, which is like, we found this speech was written for President Nixon to deliver if the astronauts didn't make it to the moon.
I love this. I have read this so many times. This is one of my favorite.
I'll just read you guys the first sentence. It's like written on like this nice parchment. It's like, you know, this opening saying like, you know, luckily we didn't have to read this speech, but we just found it. So it's like, starts, to H.R. Haldeman from William Sapphire. My fellow Americans, good evening. The astronauts have exploded. Hello. My name is President Richard Nixon. The crew members of the Apollo 11 spacecraft, Edwin Buzz Aldrin, Neil Buzz Armstrong, and Michael Buzz Collins, have become dead in space. Something went wacko with the machine, and like many great men before them, Buzz and his husbands exploded. Note, hold for applause. I mean, it just gets like crazier.
It's amazing. Honestly, continue. Says,
while the loss of these brave men is tragic, we should not weep for them, for they understood the risks of a lunar mission. They knew that space was an area where things go wacko with the machines. We made it clear that if they exploded in space, there was very little hope of putting them back together. I'm sure as their spaceship was erupting in a flaming chamber of death all around them, the astronauts were thinking, this makes a lot of sense. We can take comfort in that. Buzz and his husbands did not jump into space because they knew they would succeed. No, they went to space because mankind has an unquenchable thirst for strange new rocks. The moon is brimming with weird stones and boulders, and we want them. Mankind wants the baffling rocks, and even though these men exploded, we're going to send more men to get the rocks. I knew these men, and I knew their bravery and courage. On the night before the Apollo 11 spacecraft was launched into space by unknown forces, I came into Neil Armstrong's bedroom and woke him up. I said to him, Neil, are you scared that you will die in space? And Neil Armstrong said to me, Mr. President, I am worried about dying in space, but my irrational lust for bizarre faraway rocks is stronger than my fear of exploding. And I took Neil Armstrong's hand into my much larger hand and said to him, Neil, I want you to bring me back some cold rocks from the moon because I want to have them in my house and I want to warm up the rocks with a hairdryer and have them be warm. And Neil Armstrong said, I'll either do that or I'll explode. I don't care which one happens. Then Neil Armstrong got out of bed, walked out of his own bedroom and left his house, leaving me alone in the dark. I knew Buzz Aldrin too. He was brave and noisy. He would often boast, and then when he got to the moon, he would jam a Japanese flag into the soil just to make NASA shriek and holler. I often told him, Buzz, do not cram a flag of Japan into the soil of the moon. Do the American flag instead. And Buzz would say, with all due respect, Mr. President, fuck you. I'm going to bring 9 Japanese flags to cover the surface of the moon in Japanese flags. And then when aliens see the moon through their binoculars, they will say, I guess that thing belongs to Japan. Buzz was a great man. The less that is said about Michael Collins, the better. And so it is with a heavy heart that we bid farewell to Buzz and his magnificent husbands. They were as noble as they are dead. They've exploded all the way, and for that, we salute them. We've got to get our hands on those weird moon rocks from the moon. I want to taste the boulders of the moon. I think they will taste like yarn. We are going to send a whole new batch of space divers up to the moon tomorrow so they can get the space rocks for me. Okay, President Nixon is going back to sleep now. I love you, America. Good night, my country. I'll see you next week.
Amazing.
That guy went on to write speeches for Donald Trump.
There it is.
That makes sense. That tracks.
It does kind of sound like a Trump speech.
Yeah, it does. Like, if you read that in Trump's voice, you'd be like, I don't remember him giving this one.
Yeah, but it's like Stephen Miller, funnier than you remember.
Right. Yeah. Well, Jake, I appreciate you coming on. You're welcome anytime, and you're, you know, encouraged to run for office as soon as possible. I still feel hopeless. Well, you know what I long for? I'll leave it with this. I long for the day that I could care about things that don't really matter.
Mm.
Like, remember, like,
the dream.
2008 kind of, I was just like, what do you want to do, Ross? I want to make a movie. I'm going to make a YouTube video every week. And it's like, now what do you want? I'm like, I want, like, the climate to cool down. I'm tired of this doomsday clock staring at me.
I will say this, too, I think. I think part of that is youth, Ross. I think everyone longs for it as, like, a time that existed. And I think when we were kids, we just cared about that stuff less in a way that we just can't fully get back. So you can still find ways to not overexhaust yourself. But the idea, I mean, part of growing up is just carrying more weight. So
yeah. You become more aware of the stuff around you, and some of that stuff is hard, but I support you.
I appreciate you guys both talking to me like my dads.
Ross, can I
look, your dad and I, your other dad and I will always be here for you.
Sit down, champ. Rodrigo.
Would you like to throw a ball around with your dads?
I would.
Ross, can I tell you something that will maybe make you feel better?
Yes.
Close your eyes and imagine this. Jake McAbee, 2024.
Yeah. Oh boy, I'd be so excited to see all of the skeletons that he doesn't want coming out of the I'm like, what's the real reason you're not running, Jake? What's the darkness that you're hiding?
if I'm the answer to our problems, then we are in more trouble than I thought.
You know what's so weird? The most inspirational people that I know don't want to run for office.
Oh yeah,
and Jake is one of them. Yeah.
No, like, no one who, like, values their life and values, like, their freedom, independence, but, like, ability to create wants to run for office. Like,
you that being said, everyone listening should run for office. It's really important. Please do it.
Especially Jake McAbee, who's listening.
Look, I'm willing to sacrifice Jake's life in order for him to run for office.
You're very kind.
Yeah.
We offer you a tribute.
Very generous. Yeah.
All right, that does it for this week. Free patrons or free listeners, enjoy the full episode. Blessings to Jake for bestowing this goodness unto you. Is this helping your image, Jake?
I guess we'll find out.
Yeah.
Depends how you cut it, I guess.
If you guys want to laugh about anything political in a really nice way, go check out Jake's Twitter, at JD McAbee. And if you want to hire him, you might not be able to afford him. He's very expensive, but he's very good.
But, you know, dig in your couch cushions. Ask your parents.
I need to give a quinceañera speech, Jake, so I'm going to
It's going to be fun to watch.
Yeah. It's going to be lit.
All right. Well, thank you all for listening. I hope you guys all enjoyed the podcast, and we'll see you next week.
Love you guys.
Au revoir. Bye.